Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Who knew our foray into the final frontier started in our own backyard? Soon, moviegoers the world over will know the story of the African-American women at NASA Langley who literally helped us reach for the stars. Katherine Johnson, who still lives in Hampton, was the focal point for the project. We'll talk with the author who wrote the source material for the film, along with NASA's historian, about the film and the powerful story it tells. And in Norfolk, the city council unanimously called for the treasurer to resign after he was convicted of 6 felonies. Might be easier said than done. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. We're at 6 minutes past the hour. A little later today, we'll be talking with Virginian Pilot reporter Scott Daughtry, who's been covering the trial of Norfolk City Treasurer Anthony Burfoot. Burfoot was convicted Friday of 6 felonies related to his own service on city council before he became city treasurer 3 years ago. Council wants him out in the wake of the convictions, and you'd think he'd have to go as a result, but that's not the case because he's an independently elected official. We'll get the background, and we'll talk with Norfolk Councilwoman Andrea McClellan, who, along with her colleague Councilman Tommy Smeagol, has led an effort to get Burfoot to resign. First, though, if you're a fan of the TV series Empire, and one of us just might be, you know that when Hollywood taps to play you, the very woman who plays hip-hop mogul Cookie Lion, to perfection, you are a certifiable star. Katherine Johnson's star was set in the heavens long before Taraji P. Henson started studying her life to prepare for her role as Katherine Johnson in the soon-to-be-released movie Hidden Figures. Johnson was one of 3 African-American mathematicians working at NASA in the 1960s. They were called computers because they were humans who computed, who did math in the days before the computers that we've come to know and rely on. The film focuses on astronaut John Glenn's flight into orbital space, and he famously said he wasn't going up until Katherine Johnson confirmed the calculations. Those are some pretty high stakes. As you know, John Glenn died last week before he could see the movie. In fact, his body will lie in state in the Ohio Capitol Friday, and a memorial service is set for Saturday at Ohio State University. The film itself will screen at the Hampton Town Center AMC 24 on Christmas Eve, December 24th at 4 o'clock, and then nationwide Christmas Day. It has been a big year for Katherine Johnson. Not only is she the subject of a major motion picture, she received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama. And here is an excerpt of our conversation on WHRO TV 15, where she talks about her work calculating that trajectory for John Glenn's first orbital flight. Here's Katherine Johnson.
When John Glenn was to be the first astronaut to go up into the atmosphere and come back, and they wanted him to come back in a special place, and that was what I did. I computed his trajectory. And from then on, any time they were going to compute trajectories, they were given mostly all of them to my branch. And I did most of the work on those by hand. But when he got ready to go, he said, call her. And if she says the computer's right, I'll take it.
I love that story. 10 minutes past the hour. Marga Lee Shetterly is the author of the book Hidden Figures, upon which the film is based, The American Dream, along with the untold story of Black women mathematicians who helped win the space race. And she joins us now. Ms. Shetterly, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's my pleasure.
You're so welcome. I love that story Katherine Johnson told a few years ago, and she tells it quite often because it really speaks to something I think we have a hard time grasping today, which is the infancy of the whole science of computers. So I wonder if you could take us back to the 1960s, take us back to this moment that Katherine Johnson and her 2 friends, whom she did not want to be left in anonymity. I wonder if you could give us a sense of what the knowledge was at that time and what they were bringing to this calculation.
Sure. So, you know, I think the first thing that we have to remember is that although, you know, electronic computers are ubiquitous today, our default image in our minds when we think of a computer is this desktop appliance that you plug into the wall and, you know, or your phone that you carry with you everywhere. Back in those days, a computer was a person. It was a job title, somebody who computed. And the fact is, the space program and many, many other aspects of science and technology and defense and transportation relied on these human computers, professional mathematicians, the same way that we rely on these machines today to do our calculations for us. So this particular moment, you know, it was really so dramatic. You know, the late 50s, 1960s, early 1960s, the Soviets had zoomed ahead of the United States in space. You know, the Soviets had put up a satellite called Sputnik circling the Earth, you know, really establishing the literal high ground, you know, in space out ahead of the United States. And, you know, Americans, we were playing catch up. We were, you know, trying to figure out how to get our own satellites out there, how to make our rockets more reliable. And, you know, with the ultimate goal, obviously, of sending humans into space and bringing them home safely, which is something that Mrs. Johnson in every conversation always reminded us. It's all about bringing them home safely.
Yeah. And she as well wanted you to tell the story of her friends. I was really struck by that. I mean, it's very much who she is as a person. But when there was a conversation about this movie, she said, well, just make sure that my friends are included, and my friends and colleagues, I should say.
This is true, and this is really one of the things, you know, that is so wonderful about her story, is that, you know, she is this charismatic, brilliant, amazing mathematician, and her story and that charisma has really sparked an interest in the program in general, in the other women, in the engineers, you know. And the thing that she also always reminded me, and everyone I think who's involved in NASA knows, is that this is a team effort. You know, when we think about, you know, the most iconic moment, right, which is the Apollo 11 moon landing, and she, you know, she was also involved in providing calculations for that. 400,000 people around the world were involved in making that possible.
Wow.
You know, a staggering number of people for a staggering achievement. You know, and Mrs. Johnson, you know, she played a critical role, but she, you know, she has always made it very clear that one of the best parts about this was being part of a team, you know, and having, you know, just, it's just so thrilling, this idea of all of these smart people working together, trusting each other, doing their best, and accomplishing something that simply, you know, even today, really boggles the mind.
Yeah. Margaret, I wonder, though, you know, she did this, and she and her colleagues did this at a time when we might not have been able to imagine what the work scenario was like. If I understand correctly, she and her colleagues were working in a sort of separate area because of their race. Is that right?
That's true. So, but just to sort of, you know, put the timeline out there. So the first black women working as professional mathematicians, these computers, came to NASA, what became NASA. It was originally the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. They're working on airplanes. They came in 1943. Mrs. Johnson came 10 years later in 1953. She was originally assigned to that computing pool, which was headed by Dorothy Vaughan, who was portrayed in the movie as well as in the book. And then she, you know, what happened is, much like a secretarial pool, different groups, according to their work level, would say, hey, I need another computer. I need, you know, just like we might say, hey, I need a new computer to help me with this analysis. They said, listen, we need another computer, meaning a woman.
A woman, yeah.
Can you send her over and help us with this work? So 2 weeks after Katherine Johnson landed in Dorothy Vaughan's West Area Computing Office, the segregated office, she was selected to go over to the Flight Research Division and to work specifically on projects that involved free flight. So much of the work at Langley was with wind tunnels, but these were the people who flew planes and tested real live plane. So that's what she did. And it just happened, you know, she obviously very talented. She worked with, you know, engineers, very smart guys who really appreciated her talents. And that group happened to be, you know, one of the centers of the people who really, you know, pioneered the space program in 1957. Mm. The ones, you know, the Space Task Group, many of those people came from that division. And yeah. So as she tells the story, you know, 1957, they started working on space. She was working with those guys, and she came right along with the program.
She's an amazing person. Grew up in West Virginia. Her father worked at the very famous Greenbrier Hotel. And what she tells this story about her father especially, but her parents really emphasizing the importance of education. Greenbrier County, where she grew up, didn't have schooling for African-American students past the eighth grade. And so the children attended high school in Kanawha County, which is a long way away. And the family mm-hmm. split their time between Institute, where there's a town where the college that she went to was, and White Sulphur Springs in the summer. She graduated high school at 14. At 15, mm-hmm. she started going to West Virginia State. Graduated at 18 with degrees in math and French. Wow, an amazing, amazing story. Bill Berry is with us today. He's the chief historian for NASA. Mr. Berry, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathy.
You were a historical consultant on the film, which does a beautiful job of translating Margot Shetterly's work to the big screen. It sounds like it's a great opportunity to really highlight the role that NASA Langley has played in space flight and aeronautics.
Oh, absolutely, Kathy. And that's one of the great things about a story like this is that it brings out these sorts of unknown facts on lots of fronts, including the critical role that folks in the Hampton, Virginia area played in our early space program.
We're at 17 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Margot Shetterly, I know you have to leave us. I'm grateful for the book and grateful for this great material for a film about these extraordinary women whose story is so terrific. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. And I just want to say, you know, I'm a Hampton Roads native, and, you know, it's a pleasure to be on this program and to, you know, to speak to the people of Hampton Roads. We really have amazing history, and I think everyone in the area should be so proud that that we are telling this history that belongs to all of us.
It is very exciting indeed. I feel like we all ought to be going to the premiere. I'm sure you did. Thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're
Take
welcome.
Care. Bye.
Margot Lee Shetterly now lives in the Charlottesville area. She's the author of the book Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians who helped win the space race. We're talking about Katherine Johnson and her colleagues at NASA Langley and the story of their lives and of their experiences, which will hit the big screen in Hampton on Christmas Eve and everywhere else on Christmas Day. Bill Berry with us today is the chief historian for NASA. Bill Berry, there's always this tension between a story and its accuracy and a story and its dramatic value. Are there moments as a technical advisor for this film where there was accuracy sacrificed for drama, or the other way around?
Well, it's not a documentary, as Ted Melfi, the director, pointed out to me numerous times in our conversations. There are liberties taken with, you know, the sequencing and timing
sure.
of things and things like that. But the thing that astounded me most about working with Ted and the entire team was how committed that they were to making it as accurate as possible within the boundaries of trying to make a story that people would want to watch on a motion picture screen for 2 hours. And so they were phenomenally inquisitive about every possible aspect of things.
You know,
it was great fun.
It strikes me that as much of a story as this is about women, and as much of a story as it is about the early days of computing and the early days of the space program, this is also a story about race and a story about our nation at a critical moment in its history.
It is interesting, Kathy, to me how much the parallels sync up together like that, because it's a timeless story, and the movie I think is timeless and powerful because it speaks to these same tensions that existed back in the 60s in certain formats and still exist today in other
yeah.
ways.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And of course, this is a big year for NASA Langley coming up. 2017, the 100th anniversary of NASA Langley. They have a lot of programming underway to celebrate that that 100th anniversary. And I think when people think of space, you know, they often think of the Johnson Space Flight Center, and they certainly think of Cape Canaveral. But Langley played such a critical role.
It certainly did. Of course, it was the first center. You know, we refer to it as the Mother Center. Because the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA, was formed in 1915, but it was really literally a committee of about a dozen guys.
Wow.
That worked here in Washington. And the idea of building a research laboratory was something that was still kind of controversial, whether the government should do that or not.
Isn't that interesting?
So when they finally got approval to do it, and they got the budget to do it in 1917, construction started. So that's why we're celebrating the centennial of Langley this coming year.
And so this would have been coming in the waning days of World War I. And so it's a big year. Lots of big events coming up there, and lots of opportunities to get on NASA Langley. And that's kind of complicated, so they don't necessarily open these things all the time. So when they do, it's just a great opportunity to take your children over there and really understand, as Margalee Shetterly said, that this area played a significant role in space exploration and aeronautics. Angela's on the line from Smithfield. Hi, Angela. You're on the air.
Hi. Good day. Hi. Kathy, thank you so much for having this program. This is a great opportunity to continue to inspire children, and I see that regularly, even with elementary school-aged children. They're getting the point about the background and the history of NASA Langley and the Hidden Figures. And I'm thankful to Mr. Berry for his office, as well as NASA Langley, the author of the book, as well as the people who have created the film, because it's been providing such rich and detailed educational information. And we're able to use that in curriculum, whether it be through formal or informal outreach. So I see it every time we talk about these individuals who made such a difference behind what was going on and what you saw in the media during the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s with the space program. So thank you so much for getting this story out there and helping us inspire children.
Angela, thank you for the call. What a lovely thing to say. I know that another place where children are inspired around this issue is at the Virginia Air and Space Center, started, I think, in 2003. Bob Griesmer is the executive director and CEO thereof. Mr. Griesmer, thank you for joining us today.
Well, good morning or good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what is the Air and Space Center's connection to NASA Langley?
Well, we are actually the official NASA Langley Visitor Center, and as such, we dedicate ourselves to highlighting the magnificent historical perspective of all the accomplishments of the great minds that have been involved in the space program over the last, 100 years, but certainly the age of the conversion from the NACA to the NASA. Uh-huh. And to the space program, and we have a Gemini capsule, an Apollo, a Mercury capsule on the floor. We have the Apollo 12 capsule and the new Orion capsule that will bring us back to the International Space Station and beyond.
And you also are doing a lot of work around STEM education. Our caller noting how inspiring these stories are for young people. It strikes me that there's a particular focus on engaging young girls in STEM opportunities.
Oh my God, yes, and we have been exploding our efforts in this regard into the school systems. The quality of the educational programming that we've been engaged in has been significantly enhanced over the last 4 or 5 years, with particular attention paid to the needs of the teachers in our school systems and into the education standards that we use in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So it's tied into curriculum, but it's also tied into getting children to ask their their own questions and find answers, to be creative and curious about the science.
Yeah.
We're actually involved in a research a study right now with about 1,500 kids. We're going to be tracking them from the fourth all the way to the end of the fifth grade, and it's a truly innovative research study to find out exactly what we can do by using free choice learning environments in the sciences to get them interested in STEM careers.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Bob Griesmer. I appreciate it so much. The Virginia Air and Space Center is a great place to visit during the holidays.
Yes, thank you. We'll be open for the holidays, and we're looking forward to seeing all those families come out and enjoy the new Math Alive exhibit that we have here. We have some great IMAX space films, and we have a wonderful film on the National Parks, which is also celebrating its 100th
yeah.
year. Langley, of course, Air Force Base is celebrating 100 years. NASA is celebrating 100 years. And the Virginia Air and Space Center this same year, in 2017, will celebrate its 25th silver anniversary, serving the Greater Hampton Roads area, and we're really pleased to be part of that.
Terrific. Bob Griesmer, thank you for being with us today. We're coming up on 26 minutes past the hour. Bill Berry, as you think about this story and what it may do, you know, we've talked about educational opportunities for young people that are inspired by this. I guess I just keep thinking back to that time and what an extraordinary family Katherine Johnson came from, that cared as much about education, that went to great sacrificial lengths to make sure that this brilliant, brilliant young girl got the information and the education she needed. It's a haul between White Sulphur Springs and Institute West Virginia. So that was very sacrificial. It just strikes me that way.
Yeah, Kathy, one of the things about the movie that and the book that that Margot wrote that strikes me about all the characters in there, and the women computers in particular, but many of the folks that that worked at Langley, was the amount of sacrifice. I mean, during World War II, people worked long, long hours, 6 days a week or more, 24 hours a day to prepare for the war. And Langley played a very big role at the research center in helping us achieve the margin of victory in air power during World War II. But then as we moved into the space race, it was the same sort of thing. The pressure was really high.
Yeah.
And people made huge sacrifices, both to prepare themselves for the right kind of work, but also to get that job done. And it's just I think the movie will be very inspirational for people in that regard.
Yeah, you know, this is a story that some people in Hampton Roads sort of knew, but it really did not burst onto the scene. Well, it sort of did, and then there was a little bit of a not much talk about it, and then all of a sudden it was back.
Yeah, well, that's part of the trend in history, you know, as a historian here. Part of the trend in history is that over time you look at things in different ways. And in the early 90s, women's history sort of really started coming into its own. Jim Hansen, who was the historian down at Langley at the time, found out about the woman computer story. He thought it was fascinating.
Yes, of course.
Started gathering information about that. And so there's kind of a surge of activity. And then we stored a lot of that information away. And fortunately for us, Margot got excited about the project and came digging in our collection and has done a great job with
it. I tell you, there is so much there. Have you seen the movie yourself?
Oh, yes. I saw a rough cut back in September, and then I saw I was down there for the preview that Katherine Johnson went to earlier this month for down at the Virginia Air and Space Center.
Yeah, and it's a sadness that John Glenn didn't get to see it.
That really is.
Yeah.
It really is. Because to me, one of the movie is great in lots of ways, but one of the amazing things about the movie is it gives us a different perspective on John Glenn. We all know John Glenn as the astronaut, the icon, but in the movie you see an aspect of his character that most people don't talk much about, which is his humanity.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting. There have been also some very interesting bits of research around the letters that John Glenn received. There's a piece in the New York Times about the letters that John Glenn received from young, you know, schoolgirls about being an astronaut and, gosh, could I do that? And it was fascinating because so many of them started out with some variation of, I know I'm only a girl, comma, but, dot, dot, dot. And they have documented a lot of these letters and a lot of his response to them, which was sort of general, probably owing more to the times than anything else. And I think it's really a remarkable relationship the two of them shared. And when you think about how little, when you think about the computing power we have today, the computing power we had then, he wanted to make sure it was right. And Katherine Johnson is the woman to whom he turned to confirm that.
Absolutely true. The challenge, of course, was that we were making the shift from human computers to electronic computers at the time, but no one was quite sure if the electronic computers were being programmed properly. So when, you know, Katherine Johnson was asked to check the numbers, what she was really doing was you know, yeah, she did, you know, a couple days worth of math, actually. She literally sat down and calculated, you know, several hundred different formulas out to eight significant digits by hand. But what she was doing was checking to make sure the programming in the computer was correct, because, mm-hmm. you know, spaceflight, things happen very fast and you don't have time for a human computer to do things. So you need an electronic computer to make it work. But, you know, Glenn and other folks were concerned that the electronic computers they were relying on for his mission, whether they were actually working properly. And Katherine Johnson's huge contribution there was to prove that, in fact, the computers yeah. have been programmed properly and could be relied upon.
What are some of the other stories that you, as an historian, because I'm sure once you get around Hollywood and the books and all the rest of it, you think, wow, I've got three other great stories here at NASA that I know, as the NASA historian, would be great stories for everybody to know about. Are there a couple that come to mind for you?
Well, there are so many great stories. You know, as Margo mentioned, there were 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo program in the 60s, and many of those stories are untold. You know, we know the stories about the astronauts. We now will know the story about Katherine Johnson and the women computers, but there are lots of other folks who are unsung heroes, whose stories really ought to be told, and so I have lots of those. Although, frankly, my mind casts itself back. So, because we just celebrated the centennial of the NACA back in 2015, and all the incredible work that was done at Langley, there were some amazing characters who worked at Langley who made huge sacrifices. Like I said, during World War II and before that, I mean, really, the science of aviation that we now all take for granted happened, and the whole process of, you know, how do you find out how things work in airplanes, and how do you prove that the airplanes will fly properly and that the materials will hold up to the stresses and strains? All that work was done in Hampton by some incredible people, a very small team. There were less than 500 people working at the lab before World War II started. So there are some great stories about Fred Weick and the first woman computers. The first woman computers were actually hired a white woman in 1935, and that there's an interesting backstory behind them and how that all started. So they're don't get me started. I could go on for a long time and keep Hollywood producers busy with all kinds of ideas.
All right, fair enough. Listen, thank you so much for being with us, Bill Barry. Really appreciate it.
Kathy, it was my pleasure.
And I wish you tremendous success, and I hope you get all of those stories told and many, many more. That must be the most interesting thing, to sit as an historic advisor, a consultant on a film. So thanks again for being with us. Really appreciate it.
I've got the best job in the world.
Fair enough. We'll let you get back to it. Bill Barry, the chief historian for NASA. He is the historical consultant on the film Hidden Figures. And I think a lot of us can't wait to see that on the big screen opening nationwide Christmas Day. So we'll be back in just a few moments. We're going to take a quick check into Pledge Central. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Norfolk City treasurer. He was convicted on Friday of 6 felony counts and continues on the job today. There is an effort on the part of Norfolk City Council to get him out of that post, but we'll learn a little bit more about the vagaries of a public elected office. So let's talk about that after we take a break for a quick check-in with Pledge Central.
Thank you, Kathy. This is Sally McConnell in Pledge Central. We are coming toward the end of this shift, which has just been a wonderful experience with Randy Webb, our board chair. and with Sarah McCammon from NPR, who is now living in our neighborhood. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks. So far, our total is $18,266 over our goal of $18,000. So thank you all for everyone who has contributed this morning. It's not too late. We're well on our way to the $30,000 goal that we have for today. And the reason that we have such ambitious goals is it costs us almost $500,000 a year to bring you all of the programming that you hear on WHRV. Obviously, one of our favorites is Hearsay with Kathy Lewis. It's the chance to tell those Hampton stories, as we said, to hear about our local heroes, such as Kathleen Johnson. And without your support, we can't bring that programming on. So we look to you now to go online, whrv.org, or call 889-9476. We've just had a fantastic morning. We are so fired up.
We got a bunch of people to thank. We are fired up. And thank you all, your listener, our listeners, our members. You're the real stakeholders in everything that we have going on. Again, this is Randy Webb. I'm the board chair of WHRV. We've got a lot of people to thank. Jeff and Paula Perkins from Wake, Virginia. Those of you who don't know where Wake, Virginia is, it's up near the Rappahannock River, part of, again, this huge footprint that we deliver information and news to. So thank you to Jeff and to Paula. They say we enjoy getting the real news, not fake news. We listen all the time. We also have great returning members, Alexandra and Alex Gutnuft from Suffolk. We enjoy both HRO and HRV. Jim Roberts has called in, again, a new member. I love Hearsay. Thanks, Kathy.
We love Hearsay, too.
Absolutely. So one of the things we talk about all the time here is that we are all public radio nerds. And if you find yourself saying, I heard this on Kathy Lewis, you are indeed a public radio nerd. And so call in and give some money to join the rest of us public radio nerds.
Absolutely. I think, Sarah, you would definitely call yourself a public radio nerd.
No question, you know.
And what do you think about when you think of the term put the public in public media? What does that mean to you as a reporter on NPR?
You know, it's one of the coolest things about public media because it means that we are accountable first and foremost to the public. We're serving the public. This is nonprofit media. We're not here to make money. We are here to provide a service. And that is, you know, we're mission-oriented journalism and mission-oriented programming, which is really cool. And I think that's why public radio has endured for so long and is so special to so many people, because there's that real give and take, that real sense that listeners become members, become invested in their local stations, which in turn have the resources to pay for the programming produced by NPR and PRI programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and local programs like Hearsay. It's only possible because of that, again, that two-way street, that relationship between the listeners and the stations and the networks. And that's the whole purpose of this pledge drive, is to ask for your support to keep that coming so that we can keep bringing you those stories that really are about serving you, about keeping you informed, keeping you up to date and connected, not only with your community, but with your nation and your world. The number to call is 800-940-7170 or 889-9476. You can also contribute at whrv.org. We have crossed our midday goal of $18,000, but we're into the afternoon and we're going toward a daily goal of $30,000. So we need your support. We want you to be one of those people that keeps WHRV strong.
And one of those people, the new member, Ashton Ralston from Virginia Beach. He says, if it weren't for NPR, I'd have no idea what's going on in the world. You're my only news.
Well, right. Thank you, Ashton. So I'm going to raise a glass to that. In fact, I'm going to raise a pint to that. And if you contribute now at the $10 a month level, $120 a sustainer at that level, or at the $20 a month level for $240, we will send you either two or four public radio nerd glasses, and they're marked with a WHRV logo. That's our thank you to you for sending us a contribution. Call now at 889-9476 or go online to whrv.org and support what you love. Thank you.
Welcome back at 20 minutes before the hour. On Friday, Norfolk's treasurer, Anthony Burfoot, was convicted on 6 felony counts. Scott Daugherty is a reporter at the Virginian Pilot, who, along with a colleague, has been covering this case. Nice to have you with us today.
Glad to be here.
So we note that many of our listeners are not living in Norfolk and probably haven't been following this story terribly closely. So let's sort of broad stroke this. Anthony Burfoot was a city council person before he was city treasurer, and the convictions relate to that period of time.
Yes. Anthony Burfoot was elected, I believe, in 2002. He served as the treasurer served as a city councilman and eventually vice mayor until about 2013, when he was elected to serve as the Norfolk treasurer. From that point on, he's obviously the treasurer and he's no longer in the city council. And all of the crimes for which he was charged was when he was on city council and vice mayor. There is a slight crossover in the concept of the fact that Mr. Burfoot was a deputy city treasurer before he became treasurer.
Uh-huh.
But as far as any recall effort, which is the big thing that's going on right now, and conversations about the recall, if he wasn't elected the city treasurer, he could have basically been walking out of the treasury with the bags full of money, and it wouldn't have necessarily been a crime here that he could be recalled for, because anything happened pre-election and post-election.
So give us the sort of the thumbnail sketch of these 6 convictions. These were all related to projects. People allege they were able to bribe him to work on and to help with.
Yeah. He was convicted on 6 of the 8 counts that the federal government brought. 4 were public corruption charges. I don't usually get into the details of them are because it's federal gobbledygook, but we're talking about 4 public corruptions and then 2 perjury counts. The 4 public corruption counts primarily relate to a company called Tyvest, who was headed up by a man named Dwight Etheridge, who is now currently serving a prison sentence himself for basically being involved with the Bank of the Commonwealth case, which your listeners probably might remember from back in 2013.
Huge case, yeah.
As the prosecution case went, Dwight Etheridge was handing envelopes full of cash and buying dinner, giving cars, doing quite a few different things to help Mr. Burfoot.
One of the allegations in this case as well, and I know you've covered this, speaks to what we might call sort of the brazen nature of this. It was very, as your editorial board notes, a transactional.
There was a... it's a corrupt quid pro quo is the language that the prosecutors keep saying. And it goes along the concept of Dwight Etheridge would pay Anthony Burfoot an envelope of money or pay for a car payment or something like that. And then a week later, Anthony Burfoot might be casting a vote to help Tyvest get a contract in Broad Creek. Or the next week, Tyvest might be winning a contract to perform work, things like that. So the prosecutors tried very hard to basically draw as fine a line as possible between here's a money exchanged hands on X day, here's a vote on Y date. And that was a key part of this, is that there had to be actual official acts, mm-hmm. Unlike the McDonald case.
Yeah. And this is interesting because there was a move on city council to get him to resign. We have a lot of listeners with questions about that. We're glad to have Councilwoman Andrea McClellan, who, along with a council colleague, have been behind that effort. Councilwoman McClellan, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, good afternoon.
So give us, I think we've had a number of Facebook comments that have suggested something along the lines of, hold up, if you've been convicted of 6 felony counts, how is it you can still be on the job?
A great question and a real head scratcher. And it speaks to the nature of a constitutionally elected officer in the state of Virginia. So the treasurer is elected by the people. So the question has been asked, well, who manages, hires, and fires the treasurer? Surely he has a boss. He does. His boss are the voters of Norfolk. And so as a council, we have no authority to make a move to remove him from office. in the traditional sense. So our hands are tied, and I know that doesn't make sense to the average citizen. It shouldn't. It doesn't make sense on the face of it. But, you know, this is where elections matter.
Yeah.
And it's important that folks come out and vote. And quite honestly, the next election in November 2017, we'll be electing, I believe it's 4 constitutional officers, including the Office of Treasurer.
And so his options, or the options around Mr. Burfoot, are that he can either leave on his own, he can stay during his appeals process, I guess, or he could, I suppose, be recalled. And Scott Daugherty, that's what you've been covering as well.
The recall is a ongoing process here. And the general problem that I spoke yesterday with the special prosecutor, he's the Commonwealth Attorney for Richmond, he downplayed his case pretty significantly while speaking to me, basically saying, hey, just the fact that he was convicted for doing things as vice mayor does not mean that I've got a case here that I can really recall him, given what I've heard so far. He's saying he's going to do more research. He's going to try to...
So 6 felonies would not...
The problem is that these 6 felonies, the state code, the city charter, I'm not sure exactly the proper term, The felonies are not official until April, when the judge says you are now convicted.
I see.
And on top of that, the city charter at least says that he cannot be removed until he's already...
And he has the opportunity
to appeal.
Go through
all of his appeals.
Yeah.
That could be years.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So if I could weigh in here, a comment that was made by somebody who attended city council last night who came up to me afterwards, gentleman's a Norfolk firefighter, and he was complimentary of the council, and he said, "Ms. McClellan, understand that if I were convicted of a felony, I would be removed from my job immediately. Mm-hmm. No appeals process would wait for me." And I think that is the what folks are having a hard time with, right? Is that here is this gentleman who has been convicted of 6 charges, and he has the ability to stay in office. What we will ask if Mr. Burfoot chooses not to resign by December 15th, is we will ask for the judge to suspend his position pending the final appeals process. In that case, if the judge chooses to do so, he would take his salary. That salary would go into an escrow account. And then if he is recalled, I'm sorry, excuse me, the judge during the recall process, Judge Dalton, if he is recalled, then that money would go back to the state, who pays his salary, by the way. If he is not recalled, that money would go to Burfoot, and he would resume his job. And the suspension would be ended until the appeals process is finalized.
And so last night, you all asked him, look, please resign by Thursday, and your intention is to follow through with that.
Yes.
And this really has, I think, pointed up, and my goodness, you know, law is a complex thing, but this has really pointed up, and a lot of our listeners are wondering this as well. What you said, Councilwoman McClellan, which has to do with what we know about constitutional offices, what the rules are around that, the fact that the state pays the salary. So I think a lot of people sort of have the impression, well, you know, if you're convicted, seems like you probably lose that job.
Sure.
There are laws that govern these things differently.
There are. And not only so, I received a deluge of emails, texts, Facebook messages, phone calls, et cetera, asking all of these questions, including, of course, you know, fire him. 2, can't you withhold his salary? No, the state pays him. 3, can you take care of some of the folks who've also been associated who work in his office? No, we can't, because the treasurer has the right to hire or fire his staff, and city council and city management cannot be part of that. And all of that is really hard for folks to understand for a department that works in City Hall.
And so what are you hearing about the atmosphere in the department, about all of that? I mean, it seems like it must be incredibly tense.
I haven't had personal contact, so the comments are really anecdotal. But we have some great folks who work there. So, you know, unfortunately, everybody's tarnished. And quite honestly, the city as a whole is tarnished by this situation. And so, you know, our goal as city council is to move to the next chapter as quickly as possible.
Sure.
Thus, the request for Mr. Burfoot to resign. And it's a very unfortunate situation, and it certainly affects morale within that department and throughout the entire city. What I will tell you is that council is doing everything that we possibly can within our power to protect the city, to protect the finances of the city, and to the extent that we have the power to separate the authority of the treasurer's office from the city's monies, if you will.
And of course, that's your job, is to look out for all of that. So
yes.
Thank you so much for being with us today. And again, this this resolution brought last night, and I think it was brought by you, if I'm not mistaken, by you and Councilman Smigel. Did I get that right?
Well, let me clarify that.
Okay.
So it really wasn't brought by me or Mr. Smigel. Both of us, I think there was a universal perspective of all the council members and the mayor. So it just happened that Mr. Daughtry was able to get in touch with Tommy and me.
Got it. Okay. All right. So this is
good on him.
Yeah.
But no. So I don't want to imply that the other council members aren't behind this. We universally voted in favor of this, and what I will tell you is that there is not one council member who's more in favor of it or against it. You have a very unified voice on this, and we want to restore the trust of our citizens in the city of Norfolk, and all of us, all the council members and the mayor, feel very strongly about this, and we speak as one with one voice, and there's nobody abstaining, and there are no concerns. We all want to move on.
Yeah.
And we fervently hope that Mr. Burfoot will take us up on our request to resign.
Councilwoman Andrea McClellan, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. 8 minutes before the hour. Scott Daugherty still with us today. He covers courts for the Virginian Pilot. So this is very interesting because I think it's like so many things we've experienced recently. It's a lesson in citizenship. Courts work differently and organizations work differently.
One thing that came out in court, there was several different Virginian Pilot articles, media coverage about Mr. Burfoot that were kind of happening the first draft of history as he was, you know, there was incidents between involving Mr. Burfoot at a club with Curtis Etheridge, and that allegation basically apparently prompted a $250,000 payout request. There was other articles, and as I've talked to some people involved with this case, they've kind of pointed out when the voters elected Anthony Burfoot, they were not completely unaware of these allegations. There was an entire website
coverage about that. Yeah,
I'm probably going to mess up the number, but it was like May6thcounts.com was an entire website that was created that outlined a lot of these allegations, particularly involving connections between Anthony Burfoot and the Palace on Plume, Kenny Bullock, who was kind of a side character in the trial, but his name did come up quite a bit. This wasn't
a complete unknown.
It wasn't like the indictment was the first time that anybody had ever told the public, hey, Anthony Burfoot might have questions in his past, that there might be issues here. So, and that May 6th counts, that website was up literally as Mr. Burfoot's running for election. The Virginian Pilot covered it. The city attorney, Bernard Pisco, actually filed a lawsuit against May 6th counts to take it down. And that issue was brought up, as kind of a sidebar during the trial here as Mr. Pisco took the stand for the defense.
We should note that during the trial, developers testified, if I understand correctly, that they had paid both Mr. Burfoot and his family cash bribes, luxury autos, Outer Banks vacations, and the like. What's the situation with the family? Where are we on that?
The family was the primary part where the family came in is actually the mother of two of Anthony Burfoot's children. He has twins with a previous woman. She apparently bought a condo from Tommy Arney, who's one of the government's star witnesses. Mr. Arney testified that he basically gave her $25,000 in exchange for support, Mr. Burfoot's support on a strip club that never came to fruition in downtown Norfolk. As far as I can tell, the jury kind of dismissed a lot of what Tom Yarny was saying. From speaking with one of the jurors, they basically said, they actually found him not guilty, found Mr. Burfoot not guilty of perjury for denying those things. So that $25,000 right there, maybe it didn't happen, maybe there wasn't enough evidence, but there, that was the primary place where the family came involved, was just the mother of his two children.
What are you hearing about what the mood is in the treasurer's office and at City Hall generally?
I have not heard I've not been able to speak to anybody with the treasurer's office. These are people that were brought in by Mr. Burfoot primarily, either by him or Tommy Moss was the predecessor, and Anthony Burfoot was basically brought in to be the heir apparent. I do know that, and this is a key part of the recall effort, is that I believe it's four different employees of the treasurer's office are actually not allowed to speak to Mr. Burfoot right now. All communication between these people and
because of trial testimony.
Trial testimony, and there's still a sentencing possibility and issues like that. So he's actually under court order still. You cannot speak to Keith
McNair. Who work in his office.
Yes, he cannot speak to Keith McNair. He cannot speak to Janelle Morris, who's actually been recognized in court as his girlfriend. He's not allowed to speak to one of his chief deputies, Wendy Petchel, who is also testified that she took a trip to an Outer Banks beach house with her boss. And I want to say there was another person, but I'm suddenly blanking out on that fourth person.
It's quite the trial.
It was a fun time to cover for 5 weeks there.
Wow. So what is the next step? He obviously has an opportunity to appeal.
It's going to be he's indicating in every way he can that he's going to an appeal. There's going to be Andrew Sachs's attorneys made it clear that his client's not going to step down, that there's going to be an appeal. He's talking about some, ways that he's going to attack the jury's verdict. I'm not sure exactly what those are. He's playing that close to the vest. But this case is not going to go away. The verdict was Friday, and I've already written two stories about this case in the last 4 days.
So. Wow. Well, Scott Daugherty, thank you for coming to talk with us about it. We'll continue to check in with you as this story continues. We had a couple of posts on our Facebook page about this. Stephanie appreciating that City Council is taking a stand, and she's expressing her doubt that he will resign. Kimberly, who doesn't live in Norfolk, raised the question that we spent some time exploring in this half hour, which had to do with what the difference is between a constitutionally elected office and a city council position. So hope that's been helpful to you. Scott, thank you so much again for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Up next here on 89.5, it's Radio Lab. And then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 o'clock, it's Nature. This is, by the way, a very popular show. The horse people really love this. It's the legendary White Stallions, the story of the famous Lipizzaner Stallions, and it focuses on the bond between the horses and the caregivers. So that's coming, fairly controversial as well. That's coming up for you tonight at 8 on WHRO TV 15. And then at 9 o'clock, it's NOVA, Mystery of a Masterpiece. They're doing some imaging analysis on a portrait of a young woman that they are trying to link to Leonardo da Vinci. So that's happening, and that's coming up for you tonight at 9 on Masterpiece. Thank you so very much for joining us today. What an interesting conversation, as they always are. Hope you continue to enjoy that. We will be checking in with our good friend Jim Orband, who's going to be in the garden with us tomorrow. So dress appropriately, as we say. Thanks again for listening. If there's something you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear from you. It's hearsay@whrv.org. Thanks again. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.